Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. Coming up on the show, a historic theatre on Broadway gets a new lease on life.
Never say never, because it's just a history of up, down, change, adapt. You've got to keep reinventing yourself and reinventing your theatre.
How a theatre built by silent film stars became a shining star in downtown LA's revival. And if you are dreaming of starting the new year with a home interior makeover, listen up for Vern Yip's advice. Before we get to that, though, let's review the year just passed. DNA producer Avishai Artsy joins me in the studio for a look back at some of the stories we covered this year. And boy, what a year it's been, Avishai. At one end, we had a controversial developer become elected to the presidency.
It's been quite a year. Lots of ups and downs.
Lots of ups and downs, both locally and nationally. So, would you mind if I just started with a little bit of a downer, which was we lost some people this year?
Yes.
Starting with David Bowie, right back in January, hugely influential on all music, style, design. And then very shortly afterwards, Prince.
Two David huge Bowie. Music icons, and fashion was a very important part of their presentation.
Also, massive influence in architecture, Zaha Hadid. Cannot overstate how important she is.
And her buildings were really known for those kind of swooping lines.
Swooping complex curves. She preceded the digital architecture explosion, but she utilized that tool to a level that many people look at with great admiration. Some great individuals that we've lost. The year has been marked by a lot of tension, actually, both at the level of the presidential campaign, but locally, we've been seeing some fights around issues that are playing out in global cities.
LA is going through some growing pains, and we're seeing that in terms of the housing crunch. The city is directing more, and the county is directing more funding to build more housing for the homeless. We also talked about the battle over gentrification in places like Boyle Heights, which are largely immigrant, working class, and a lot of those people are being displaced. So there's a lot of tensions over where that housing should go and what it should look like.
Massive fears of gentrification, so people fighting development, even as development is necessary and might even help alleviate the desperate shortage of affordable housing.
And this is a battle that's really going to continue into the new year with Measure S, the Neighborhood Integrity Initiative, on the ballot in March. So people will be deciding whether to place limits on the possibility of zoning exemptions.
These tensions surrounding growth are coming up against sort of the desire on the part of some to really see some great architecture join some of the other talents that are already in LA. We're suddenly getting a surge of some of the world's sort of top name architects being brought in by LA developers to come and work on designs. For example, Herzog & de Meuron on Alameda and 6th in downtown, the Swiss architect firm Bjarke Ingels, Danish architect, tapped to design another huge complex in the Arts District. We have Rem Koolhaas, the Dutch architect, who's designed a project in Santa Monica.
And meanwhile, you have these ongoing preservation battles. So the former Metropolitan Water District building in Echo Park that William Pereira built, it looks like it's going to be torn down. Same with Pereira's LACMA building. It might be that Peter Zumthor, another European architect, might be replacing it, although we'll see where that goes because there's a lot of contention over that design.
All of this coincides with another big change, I guess, in LA, which is we're moving gradually from predominantly car-based culture to much more mass transit.
To mass transit. And we saw the passage of Measure M, which will bring a huge increase in spending on extensions of existing rail lines and also sidewalk repairs and bike lanes. This year, we saw the extension of the Expo line. Besides that, we're seeing kind of more advances in terms of Hyperloop and self-driving cars. Los Angeles may become a testing ground for some of these technologies.
And we should add to all of that, this year has also been marked by, let's just call it a debate around the LA River. You and I have covered some pretty important and serious stories this year. We've also covered Terrifying, which was Skyspace, the glass slide on the US Bank Tower, 1,000 feet above the ground. And we also covered Fun. Tell us what was one of your favorite stories this year.
Probably my favorite was visiting the Sheets Goldstein House, which was acquired by LACMA, and its current owner, James Goldstein, who is an eccentric person in his style and in his lifestyle. And it was really fun and kind of strange to visit him and have him show me around his beautiful house designed by John Lautner. So that was one of my favorite segments. I have to say the other one was cargo shorts. Probably the story that we got the most response to, strangely, of anything we've done this year.
The most trivial and got the most response. There is a message there, but it turns out it's not trivial at all. There's a battle, mostly between men and women, over whether the guys should be wearing cargo shorts.
Yes.
And our our colleagues Brandon Devine and Eric J. Lawrence had such a funny
they
debate about that.
And there are strong opinions on both sides.
Yes, there certainly are.
What about you, Francis? What was your favorite
story? Well, I loved cargo shorts. I also did enjoy and was also slightly freaked out by having a cocktail mixed by a robot when I visited South by Southwest a bit earlier this year.
How was that cocktail? Not to
it wasn't
liking.
Very good. Yeah, I think you'd probably have mixed me a better cocktail, Avishai. I believe there's still a future for human beings.
As bartenders.
And hopefully still some other jobs. Anyway, well, Avishai, it's been a wonderful year working with you. Happy New Year. And thank you all for listening to the program. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Now a look toward 2017, and maybe you're harboring those New Year fantasies of making some changes in your life, perhaps even your home. And we know where that leads, to the New Year sale at your local furniture store. At this point, Vern Yip's advice will be stop and think before you leap. Vern Yip is an interior designer and was the longtime makeover artist on the Learning Channel's interior design show Trading Spaces. Now he's written a book. It's called Vern Yip's Designwise, Your Smart Guide to a Beautiful Home. And he says the book marks the culmination of a long and winding journey.
I'm Chinese American, and my parents came to the U.S. when I was 2 months old. And like many Chinese American children and Asian American children, you're told that you have two choices in life. You can grow up and you can become a doctor, or you can grow up and you can become a doctor. So, you know, you pick. Being a very obedient son, I was a pre-med student at the University of Virginia, and I studied chemistry and economics. I spent nearly every break working at the Transmitted and Transfused Viruses Laboratory at the National Institutes of Health. And every day that I would go in, I wouldn't be focused on what was at hand. I would be focused on the fact that the lighting was so bad, and why are the walls this atrocious yellow? And, you know, it was the sure sign that I was not doing what I was supposed to be doing. And 2 weeks before medical school was about to commence, I finally mustered up enough courage to go to my mother and say, you know, look, I can't do this. I've always known my entire life that I'm supposed to design. I've always known my entire life I love architecture. And so she said, go for it.
But it seems as if your mom wasn't that surprised when you made this revelation.
No. Are moms or parents in general ever surprised? I mean, your parents always know what's going on and they always know what you're up to. My mother was my primary caregiver. My father left when I was about 7. And so she really almost single-handedly raised me and just had this incredible belief in me. And it was really like empowering because, you know, I would do drawings, for example, of my dream bedroom set when I was 7 or 8, and then she would have it made. Like she would actually have it manufactured, or she had me sketch out the addition to our home when I was 10. And then she took the drawings to the county and got the drawings approved for the addition. So it's been a great lesson for me as a parent now because, you know, we have 2 small children. We have a 5-year-old and a 6-year-old. And just in terms of what can happen when you really get behind your child.
So armed with that childhood, this empowering childhood that you had, you then wound up in this large architecture firm. You were taken under the wing of the head of interior design. You were given this job working for the Disney cruise ship. And then you get into designing residential work, and you do quite a lot of high-end interiors, you know, working for people who can really afford design. But you also go on this other path of basically making design accessible to people who are trying to decorate their homes on a budget.
You have to wind the clock back and think about 2000, you know, that year. And back then, you didn't have companies who were big box national retailers offering goods that were well-designed and well-priced. That really wasn't, for the home at least, that really wasn't where, you know, people's brains were. And shows like Changing Rooms, shows like Trading Spaces really began to kind of make people aware that their homes could be reflections of them and could be well-designed. And if they were well-designed, the quality of their life could improve.
It seems like it's self-evident to say that good design improves your life, but it kind of isn't. You've sort of proved that point by your own experience working in the hospital where you hated the yellow paint and the lighting. Why does good design improve people's lives?
Well, when you are either working or living in a space that feels supportive of the activity that you're engaged in, it really can boost your mood. It can boost your productivity. It can boost the kinds of engagements that you have with your coworkers or the people that you're living with. But when it comes to your home especially, I always say to people, it's really important for your home to be a physical manifestation of you, for you to drop this incredible pressure that we all feel to live up to somebody else's standards. Forget all of that and get back to what makes you happy. And when you begin to invest the time to design your house in a way that is both functionally and aesthetically reflective of you and those who live there, you will find that you end the cycle of constantly having to redesign it, and that when you walk through the front door, it is the place that you want to be more so than any other place on the planet.
What you've just described is our emotional connection with our surroundings. And that is ultimately the message of your book. But to get to that place, you actually suggest that people do a lot of math. Can you explain that?
Okay, well, first off, I don't want people to get intimidated or scared by numbers. When it comes to designing your home, a lot of people experience paralysis. And so this book really is supposed to empower them by saying, look, a lot of design isn't ethereal, it isn't mystical, it isn't something that's discussed and decided by designers in some dark corner of a room somewhere and then we just sort of throw it out there. A lot of it's very logical and a lot of it's concrete. And once you give people the concrete portions of design, it frees them up to then make the decisions that, you know, they want to make aesthetically. So no matter if you're renting the smallest studio apartment or you're a multi-billionaire living in a 40,000 square foot mansion, your dining room table is still going to be somewhere between 29 to 31 inches in height. And because we have that standardization, because we're all mostly about the same size once you take off the, you know, far extremities, a lot of these rules then can really help you in terms of laying your room out.
So what you have is a number of chapters that break down our furnishings by height and then their related proportions. So how far an armchair should be from another armchair, how far a coffee table should be in relation to the sofa, how far the rug should extend beyond the coffee table. So it's standardized sizes plus their relationships to each other that I took away from this. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. And I'm not an actor. I'm not playing a character on television. I'm me. And so when people see me on the street, they feel very casual and easy, like they've known me all their lives. And they'll say, hi, Vern, how are you? And by the way, I'm dying to know, how high should I hang my pictures? I mean, I'm getting these questions all the time, and I realized even though a lot of this information is out there on the internet and you can Google it or whatever, it's oftentimes not put together in one spot, and it's oftentimes not explained in a really accessible fashion. 60 inches, by the way, is the height that you should be hanging your pictures from the finished floor to the center of the pictures. And we say 60 inches because that is the average human eye level. So that's really what, you know, this is about, is giving you those very accessible tools to implement and make those decisions to finish your room.
Which brings me right back to how we begun, talking about how our lives generally have changed, because now on Main Street, you can find these big box stores where you can buy affordable, decently designed furniture. But the downside of that is that we've all become these kind of mass consumers of furnishings. And, you know, can one get into a kind of excess of consumption where we sort of don't know how to rein it in?
Yes. You know, it's very tempting to just purchase something because you think it's a great deal. But if you don't have that space plan that says you really need a rectangle coffee table, round coffee table isn't going to serve your purpose, but that round coffee table that you love is on sale, you know, it's not going to be a good use of your funds, even if it's the bargain of the century, if it's not the right size for what you need to do. So I always ask people then to take a step back and to be informed about what they're buying. Number one, make sure it's of quality. But number two, really, really make sure that you love it. loving it, I think, is important. Not just liking it and not just getting the adrenaline rush of getting something at a huge bargain, but loving it.
Vern Yip is author of Vern Yip's Design Wise, your smart guide to a beautiful home. So what does a man with a discerning eye like Vern think of our famously unglamorous basement studio? We took him on a tour, starting in the hallway.
Well, it's a little on the clinical side. I'm not a huge fan of fluorescent lights, even in commercial spaces. And, you know, the great thing is, now that we have LED technology, the color spectrum's much warmer, it's dimmable, and it's more flattering. I would say this lighting is very efficient.
So what about the walls?
Well, I don't have a problem with white walls, but, you know, not all whites are created equal. And in a situation like this, where you have really harsh fluorescent lights and you have no natural light penetrating this space, it really is subterranean. You have to pick a white that has a little bit of a warm undertone in it. I feel like somebody probably got a great deal on this white and probably just used it pervasively.
Now, as we turn the corner, what do we see? But we see water.
Yes. Well, you've certainly embraced the functional aspects of design here. I know where to get my water and I know where to dispose of my trash, which is really...
The other thing you can see is the trash can as we turn the corner.
Yes, yes, yes. So it's really important when you're really thinking about a design for function and aesthetics to come together. Here, I would say there's been a little more emphasis placed on functional than there probably should be.
We then brought Vern into the newsroom.
I think the first word that comes to my mind is joyless. It's well laid out, and I can see that people can get around and get to their desk. However, it's completely void of any kind of personality. When you walk in here, it's a primary example of not knowing where to look. You are overstimulated and understimulated simultaneously. That's quite an achievement. To have it be like this void of personality, but yet have so much stuff up on the walls. So I would say that you could use a little bit of design in here. It's just even one focal point. For example, if you dropped a pendant fixture of, you know, some sort of magnitude or scale in the middle, it would at least give your eye a floating piece of art to consume.
That was Vern Yip. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. And after this short break, we'll visit a gorgeous theatre in downtown LA that's had some dramatic ups and downs. Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. New Year's Eve is around the corner, and where are you planning to party? Well, one place you might find yourself is at a disco dance party at the theatre at Ace Hotel. Yes, this is the theatre that, along with the Orpheum Theatre, the Globe, the Mayan, the Belasco, is part of a revival of historic theatres in downtown. But this one stands out for its opulence, for the diversity of its programming, and for its very colourful history. Gideon Brower has the story.
The movie star murals, the vaulted lobby, the ornate organ grills, the encrusted stalactites dribbling from the ceiling. You look around the spectacularly over-the-top interior of the old United Artists Theater, and you have to wonder, where did all this come from? The story begins in the 1920s. It was the heyday of silent films, and America was in love with the movies. Hilsman Wright is co-founder of the Los Angeles Historic Theater Foundation.
In those days, people would go to the movies 2, 3, 4 times a week. In many cases, people didn't even care what the movie was. They decided which theater they were going to go to that night.
Audiences were transported not just by the film, but by the building. That was the Movie Palace experience. S. Scott Norton heads the Historic Theater Foundation.
It's leaving your troubles at the door and you're walking into a fantasy world. Some theaters, they're designed to take you to a foreign land, something that at the time was a mystery, like Egypt or China.
Many theaters were built and owned by the studios themselves. There were big players like Warner Brothers, Paramount, RKO, MGM, and Fox, and small players like United Artists, founded in 1919. Ed Kelsey is a Los Angeles builder and a theater historian.
United Artists basically started out as 4 movie stars.
well, three movie stars and a director. And they got together and decided if they formed their own company, they could release their own films and not be controlled by the other studios.
The four founders were actors Mary Pickford, Douglas Fairbanks, and Charlie Chaplin, and director D.W. Griffith. Today, Chaplin is the best remembered of that group, but in her day, Mary Pickford, America's sweetheart, was an even bigger star. In 1920, she married Fairbanks, a major star in his own right, and the first screen Zorro. They were the movie's original power couple. And like their partners in UA, they were tired of making money for other people.
This was really an attempt for the artists themselves to have that complete control. So producers all the way to distribution.
By 1926, they were turning out enough movies to flourish. But the premier theaters in the big cities were owned by rival studios who wouldn't book UA films. The partners decided to build their own theaters. And in Los Angeles, in the 20s, there was only one place to put your movie palace.
It had to be on Broadway. All of your shopping, your theaters, your business, everything really was here in downtown Los Angeles, and Broadway was the entertainment capital.
Theaters were going up all over the district, says Annie Lasky of the Los Angeles Conservancy.
Across the street in one block down is the Orpheum Theater, which was Vaudeville House 1926, and then the State Theater, which was 1922, the Tower Theater, which was also in the early 20s.
United Artists found a location south of 9th Street. They hired architects, C. Howard Crane for the theater, and Walker and Eisen for the 13-story office building that would rise above it. In May of 1927, 5,000 people came to the site to watch Mary Pickford press the lever on a steam shovel to break ground for the new building. Where other theaters on the street looked like opera houses or the inside of a Spanish galleon, the United Artists would be a European castle. Or more accurately, a Hollywood version of a European castle. There's a difference.
If you look up at the ceiling of the lobby, those frescoes are really sort of medieval English with knights and Robin Hood kinds of scenes, and very different than the Spanish Gothic stuff that's in the actual theater.
The main lobby opens up again into three stories of incredible Gothic ornamentation, vaulted ceilings. The light fixtures, I think, are about 8 feet tall. They resemble torches. There is not an inch of this enormous room that is not ornamented.
United Artists Theater flung open its portals for the first time Monday night. The occasion was one of super brilliance, with virtually all of the first magnitude stars of filmdom present. Mayor Cryer made the initial remarks, followed by John Barrymore, who then introduced Miss Pickford, who spoke the words of dedication.
That's how the Los Angeles Times described opening night, December 26, 1927. The reviews for the theater were ecstatic. Motion Picture News called it the final word in theater construction. The LA Times called it a rhapsody in gold. But the spectacular opening would be the high water mark for UA, Pickford, and Fairbanks. Silent films were on their way out, and both their careers and their love affair were in decline. Pickford made her last film in 1933, and the couple divorced in 1936, setting another precedent for Hollywood power couples. Like many downtown theaters, the United Artists opened and closed repeatedly during the Depression. But the advent of World War II brought a huge resurgence.
There were so many people that were working long hours, and downtown was where everybody changed streetcars and buses. Most of the theaters were open 16, 18, 20 hours a day.
It didn't last. Returning GIs started families and started watching television in the suburbs. Downtown audiences declined. And for much of the 1950s, the United Artists was closed, with one notable exception.
Mike Todd decided that he was going to make it one of the two locations where he was showing Oklahoma.
Oklahoma, where the wind comes sweeping down the plain.
Producer Mike Todd had developed a widescreen process called Todd AO, using 70mm film turned on its side. The widescreen projection meant major modifications for the United Artists. The proscenium on either side of the stage was torn out to install a huge curved screen. The lower balcony was removed and a new projection booth installed in its place. Oklahoma ran for almost a year at the United Artists.
Oklahoma, okay.
After Oklahoma was over, the UA closed for 10 years and sat empty.
As the city demolished the Bunker Hill neighborhood in the 1960s to develop a new downtown center, the old Broadway buildings emptied out. Theater operators responded to the changing demographics of Broadway.
Metropolitan theaters, they took over the UA and started programming in Spanish language.
Mire, friend, aquí hay lo interesante. No me dirás que para esta chamba también te van a exigir que sepas inglés.
Pues ya ves que nos hemos pegado cada chasco.
To make extra cash, theater management filled their lobbies with video arcade machines. Then things got really weird at the United Artists.
Do you understand? A God's work hangs on $600 miserable dollars.
Preacher Gene Scott took over the theater and the office building in 1989.
And you sit there glued to your chair. How long must I teach you the principles of spiritual warfare?
Scott renamed the building the Los Angeles University Cathedral, but he kept the United Artists marquee. He interspersed his lectures with singing groups, footage of his team of show horses, and demands for donations. Whatever you make of Dr. Scott's theology, he was a good steward of the theater, and he set his followers on a massive cleanup of the building. After 15 years in the theater, Gene Scott died in 2005, and his widow put both the theater and the office building on the market. She was determined to find a buyer who would love the buildings as much as Dr. Scott had.
There were some very, very rich offers thrown their way that would have torn the theater down as a construction staging site and eventually would turn into a garage while the office building was converted into condos.
They turned down those offers and kept looking for the right buyer for years.
It was one of those things that you look at and you're like, this is crazy, this is crazy, this is crazy, let's do it, and you jump.
Kelly Sauden is one of the partners at Ace Hotel, with locations in New York, Seattle, Portland, and other cities. They ran some small performing venues, but they never attempted anything on the scale of the 1,600-seat United Artists. Ed Kelsey worked on the renovation.
It still had the original 1927 air conditioning system, still had the original electrical system, the original plumbing. None of that had ever been improved.
The Ace Hotel and the newly named Theater at Ace Hotel opened in early 2014. The timing was right, with downtown's resurgence and thousands of new young residents eager for local entertainment.
The Ace was just like, okay, let's have panel discussions, and let's have ballets, and let's have hip-hop concerts, let's have regular concerts, and let's have classical music, let's have movies, let's just get things happening here.
Such as a dinner and disco party this New Year's Eve. Almost 90 years after its opening, the theater is part of a larger effort by business and property owners and elected officials to revitalize Broadway. And it's proof that a district, a street, even a building type long out of fashion can come back stronger than ever.
Never say never, because it's just a history of up, down, change, adapt. You've got to keep reinventing yourself and reinventing your theater.
For DNA, I'm Gideon Brower.
Gideon Brower's story comes to us through KCRW's independent producer project with additional support from the file-sharing service WeTransfer. I'm Frances Anderton. That's it for today's DNA. Avishai Artsy is the show's producer. Ray Guana mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman and Jackie Liu. Thank you very much for listening. Stay tuned for The World, coming up next.